It is Tuesday, September 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump calls on world leaders to isolate Iran.
Iran's leaders sow chaos, death, and destruction.
The United States joins the United Nations in condemning the security crackdown in Myanmar, and New Zealand celebrates the 125th anniversary of women's right to vote. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump called on world leaders gathered at the UN General Assembly to isolate Iran's regime as long as its aggression continues.
Iran's leaders sow chaos, death, and destruction. They do not respect their neighbors or borders or the sovereign rights of nations. Instead, Iran's leaders plunder the nation's resources to enrich themselves and to spread mayhem across the Middle East and far beyond.
Trump complimented North Korea, which he disparaged at the UN last year. He noted that he and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un met in Singapore in June.
Since that meeting, we have already seen a number of encouraging measures that few could have imagined only a short time ago. The missiles and rockets are no longer flying in every direction. Nuclear testing has stopped. Some military facilities are already being dismantled. Our hostages have been released, and as promised, the remains of our fallen heroes are being returned home to lay at rest in American soil. I would like to thank Chairman Kim for his courage and for the steps he has taken, though much work remains to be done.
I spoke with VOA United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir and said to her that the theme of this speech seemed to be America first.
Right, and that was no surprise to anybody in the hall, I think. I think people were more concerned to hear what would his message be this year, because last year he gave the famous Rocket Man speech and said the United States would totally destroy North Korea if they continued to pursue nuclear weapons. And I think a lot of member states were concerned to see who he might have in his sights this year. But we knew he would speak about Iran, but actually he wasn't as tough or strong or threatening as on Iran as many expected him to be. So I think it was a pretty calm speech for him compared to last year, and he covered a lot of themes, including this issue of national sovereignty. And he said, the United States will not tell you how to work or live or worship, and we ask that you honor our sovereignty in return.
He said the United States wanted, you know, is interested in countries that have the best interests at heart, that the United States wants to help its friends.
Right, and he was talking specifically about foreign assistance. And we've heard this for several weeks now, that the State Department's going to undertake a review of U.S. foreign aid. And we've heard it from Ambassador Haley here at the United Nations. I think we've heard it from Mike Pompeo as well, that we're going to give our aid dollars where countries have similar interests to the United States and treat the United States well. And he basically said that today. And he said, we're going to see whether these countries have our interests at heart. And we're only going to give aid to those countries that respect us and are our friends. So he was quite clear about it, this being sort of the U.S.'s new foreign aid policy.
So is that quite a switch from what has existed in previous administrations?
It is. And it sort of makes foreign assistance not about humanitarianism or other national security interests, but makes it much more transactional.
Trump also spoke about how he wants other countries to pay their fair share, and I believe that's to do with UN peacekeeping troops.
True, and that's, you know, again, not a new theme for him. We've heard it at NATO. We've heard it in other places. He said the United States will not pay more than 25% of the UN peacekeeping budget. And in fact, that's how much the U.S. is supposed to pay. It's crept up over the last decade or so to about 28%. But last year, Nikki Haley sort of worked with the committee that funds peacekeeping, and they brought it back down. So the U.S. has diminished its contribution to peacekeeping by several hundred million dollars, in fact, but it's really within where it's supposed to be.
Earlier, you mentioned President Trump speaking about North Korea. He seemed almost complimentary about North Korea in his speech today.
Yes, he said he thanked Chairman Kim for the courage and the steps he's taken, although he said much work has to be done, and he added that sanctions will stay in place until denuclearization happens. He said that much has gone on, you know, more than people realize, and that he thanked the countries who've helped, you know, China, South Korea, Japan. He said that they're critical support. They need critical support going forward.
He also talked about Chinese tariffs, and he said he has personal respect for President Xi Jinping, but he talked about, he said that the trade imbalance with China and I guess with other countries is not acceptable.
Right, and he said he wouldn't tolerate it. That was his word, tolerate. We won't tolerate it. And he said this trade imbalance is not acceptable. And he did single out the Chinese. He said after they joined the World Trade Organization, the United States lost over 3 million manufacturing jobs, nearly a quarter of all steel jobs, and 60,000 factories in the United States closed after China joined the WTO. So he said, you know, we won't let our workers be abused and our wealth be plundered. And I think part of that, don't forget, we're moving into the midterm election season in the United States. And I think that's as much a message to China as it is to his base voters, that I'm here for you, I'm protecting you.
He also talked about energy, you know, oil production, and he said that OPEC is ripping off the world.
Yeah, that actually really surprised me because a lot of the OPEC countries are his best friends. So I was sort of surprised he went after them. But he said, I don't like it and nobody should. And we defend many of these nations for nothing and then they take advantage of us. Not good. So I guess he's getting ready to have a conversation with some of his friends in OPEC. He also took a swipe at the Germans, surprisingly, saying that they'd become totally dependent on Russian energy if they don't immediately change course. And at that moment, the TV cameras panned over to the German delegation, and the foreign minister and the ambassador here, who used to be Angela Merkel's national security advisor, were both sort of giggling at the table when he mentioned Germany. So I don't know how upset they were about it.
I noticed.
And that was not the only laugh the president got, because he opened saying that I stand before you today to share the extraordinary progress we've made. And he, in his tendency towards hyperbole, said we've accomplished more than any administration in the history of our country. And there was audible laughter in the General Assembly Hall. And the president recognized it and said, well, I didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay.
Yeah, he kind of laughed, too.
He did. He did. It's not, you know, he likes his rallies, and the United Nations is not a rally in West Virginia. It's a different audience. But I think there's one thing I'd like to mention, though, that you didn't cover, which stood out to me as one of the most important things that he said in the speech that may not get the headlines, but it's a tremendous blow to international accountability and justice. Yeah. He mentioned the International Criminal Court, and the United States is not a signatory to the court, but it has never stood in its way in prosecuting dictators and warlords and people who've committed atrocities, including genocide and crimes against humanity. And today he said that the ICC has no jurisdiction or legitimacy or authority. And I think that's going to be a tremendous blow to the court. It could even be the beginning of the end of the court, because if the United States is not backing the court, it's going to be very hard. I mean, it was great news to Bashar al-Assad and to the military in Myanmar and to dictators and bad guys around the world today when he said that.
Mm-hmm. Although I think former President George W. Bush was also very critical of the court.
He was critical of the court. He did not obstruct the court, though. The problem is that the ICC prosecutor has been looking at the behavior of U.S. troops in Afghanistan, and this has spurred this sort of stiffening of the U.S. spine against the court. And John Bolton, who's the president's national security advisor, has never been a fan of the International Criminal Court. And so I think one can see his hand in this.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Margaret.
Thank you, Sarah.
Margaret Bashir reporting from the United Nations. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. A South Sudan surgeon wins the United Nations Award for aiding refugees. India welcomes the opposition victory in the Maldives. The U.S. is concerned about Hong Kong's official ban on a pro-independence party. And the U.S. Senate is brawling over the Supreme Court nomination of Brett Kavanaugh. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
An international group of astronomers have captured what is being called the first confirmed image of a planet forming near a young dwarf star. The group, led by scientists at the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy in Heidelberg, Germany, found the newborn planet making its way through a protoplanetary disk of dust and gas that surrounds a low-mass variable star called PDS 70. The young star is located in the Centaurus constellation and is about 370 light-years from Earth. Observational data suggests the still-forming planet called PDS 70b has a cloudy atmosphere and is about 3 billion kilometers from its host star, which is approximately the distance between our Sun and Uranus. The discovery of the planet and its image were made by the SPHERE instrument on the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope in Chile. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, after India legalized gay sex, the battle for societal acceptance begins. We'll have a report. The U.S. government has joined the United Nations in issuing a scathing report about the security crackdown in western Myanmar, also known as Burma, accusing the military of waging a well-planned and coordinated campaign of mass killings, gang rapes, and other atrocities against the Rohingya Muslim minority. The report's conclusions could, according to U.S. officials, lead to further sanctions, although it did not propose any new steps. The report is based on more than 1,000 interviews with Rohingya, among the hundreds of thousands who fled Rakhine State to refugee camps in Bangladesh following the crackdown beginning in August of last year. It characterized the violence as extreme, large-scale, widespread, and geared toward terrorizing both the population and driving it out. It comes on the heels of a similar UN report that described the crackdown as having genocidal intent. Nicholas Farrelly is Associate Dean of the College of Asia and the Pacific at Australian National University. He spoke with International Edition's Victor Beatty.
With the evidence mounting up, there will, of course, be more calls for punitive measures against the Myanmar authorities based in Naypyidaw, and we'll need to wait and see exactly what some of the details of this most recent round of accounts and allegations look like.
A month ago, the U.S. government imposed sanctions on 4 military and police commanders and 2 army units, but Myanmar's military chief was spared, and there appears to be little U.S. appetite for broader economic sanctions. Why do you think that?
That comes down to geopolitics. It comes down to an assessment of where the points of leverage and influence might be. It also comes down to a variety of uncertainties around exactly who was involved in authorizing the violent purges and pogrom of 2017. While some of those matters are still being worked through, it's likely that we're not going to see a really consistent and comprehensive effort to target Myanmar, and instead we will have much more focused and specific designations to include for some of the senior military officers who were allegedly involved in these atrocities.
This U.S. report, based on about 1,000 interviews of refugees in Bangladesh, described horrific acts of killing infants and small children, shooting unarmed men, victims buried alive or thrown into mass graves, widespread sexual assault. Are these matters that were carried out, in your view, by local unit commanders, or were they directed right from the top?
It's always hard to say in Myanmar exactly where responsibility sits within the chain of command, but those of us who've been looking at Myanmar's internal political affairs for a long time appreciate that the command center is Naypyidaw, the country's relatively new capital, and from Naypyidaw, many of the decisions have been made that led to these horrendous crimes from 2017. And So exactly who and where and what and how is likely over the years and decades to come to be an issue of great concern to all of us who care about seeing justice for the victims of many of these terrible things that have happened.
Given China and Russia's veto power in the Security Council, can the international community do anything about these atrocities?
That's what makes it so very hard. And given the overall geopolitical landscape, given the challenges that we all face when there are authoritarian regimes that are going to provide extra support for their own opportunistic purposes, we should remember in a case like the one we all currently face in Myanmar, then we need to work smart and we need to be prepared to accept that there will be many frustrations along the way, because it's not going to be quick or easy to firstly get to grips with exactly what happened, because that's not in the interests of the Myanmar government or perhaps China or Russia too, to understand exactly what happened in Northern Rakhine State last year. And then, of course, much longer term, we need to be able to maintain some fancy diplomatic footwork to do whatever's possible to work through the various United Nations or other global level processes to then work out how it is that responsibility can be attributed to various of Myanmar's security actors. And then, of course, let's not lose sight of the fact that there are still almost a million people living under tarpaulins in southeastern Bangladesh. Those people aren't going anywhere, and they're going to need to be looked after for the very long term.
Nicholas Farrelly of the Australian National University. The International Criminal Court last week said it's examining where alleged forced deportations of Rohingya constitute war crimes or crimes against humanity. At the same time, the U.S. announced it's providing $185 million to provide food, water, health care, and other critical aid for the Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh. A landmark ruling earlier this month that overturned a ban on gay sex in India has overjoyed the LGBT community. But the road ahead in building societal acceptance will be long and difficult in a largely conservative country. As Anjana Pusricha finds out, some activists are making a beginning in schools and colleges where the subject is mostly taboo.
Away from their enthusiastic participation in annual gay pride marches, India's LGBT community struggles to find safe spaces from a young age.
But when it comes to the student community, they're still living in a very backdated time. And, you know, they call us names, they tease us, they bully us.
As efforts to change those attitudes gain momentum after the Supreme Court legalized gay sex, a packed audience turns up for a workshop on gender and sexuality at the Indraprastha College for Women in Delhi University. Undergraduate student Lakshita Jain says the ruling has facilitated more open discussions on LGBT issues.
They need to be aware of it, maybe because they've been confused about themselves or they need to accept others. So I think it's very crucial, because this is something that nobody talks about at home or not even at school. So in the college atmosphere, it is very important, you know, because this is the time when you discover yourself.
The two-hour session is animated as students raise questions and listen attentively on the right to gender choices that may not conform to existing societal norms. Rituparna Bora of Nazaria, a queer feminist group that organized the workshop, says grassroots change is crucial.
If you could introduce these concepts of equality, equity, justice, LGBTIQ issues, gender, sexuality, I think things will be much better when they grow up. That's what we feel. And that's why we aim at schools and colleges. Plus, many queer people also face a lot of violence in the education sector.
Such interactions are important in a country where only a handful of colleges have LGBT support groups.
When we understand the foundations, it is only then we start thinking about it. We come in terms of acceptance of it, and maybe exploring it within ourselves also, of maybe if we have also felt it that way.
Holding the workshop in an all-women's college is significant. In a patriarchal society, women in the LGBT community face a bigger challenge than do men, says Ritambara Mehta of Nazaria.
It's a lot difficult for women to be out and open about their wishes, their desires, their wants.
The legal battle to lift the criminal tag off gay sex took nearly two decades. The struggle to change mindsets will also be long, but the journey has begun. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. New Zealand has marked the 125th anniversary of a historic move to give women the vote. It was the first country in the world to enact suffrage for women. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Jacinda Ardern, New Zealand's third female prime minister, said the nation's 19th century fight for economic independence and equal rights was still continuing. The gender pay gap in the South Pacific nation is on average 10%, although for working mothers it's about 17%, a pay difference known as the motherhood penalty. Women are also underrepresented in some senior corporate positions. Among New Zealand's top 50 listed companies, female executives make up just a fifth of directors. In September 1893, New Zealand passed an electoral act that gave women over the age of 21 the right to vote in parliamentary elections. Schools, theatres, museums and libraries have hosted events commemorating the world-first legislation and discussions about how to achieve greater equality. In Parliament, Prime Minister Ardern praised the campaigners who'd brought about fundamental change all those years ago.
First and foremost, a tribute to the woman who led the change, to Kate Sheppard, to Margaret Sievright, to the 25,000 women who signed the petition in 1893. I move that this House mark the 125th anniversary of New Zealand women becoming the first in the world to win the right to vote and celebrate the contribution of women to New Zealand's democracy, past, present and future.
A union representing public service workers in New Zealand has held an equal pay strike, demanding an end to wage discrimination. The centre-left Ardern government, which came into power a year ago, has also this week brought in new laws designed to make it easier for female employees to make claims for equal pay. About 40% of New Zealand lawmakers are women, but fewer than a third of government ministers are female. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The founders of photo-sharing app Instagram announced this week they would be leaving parent company Facebook to explore other ventures. Their resignation follows rumors of tensions with Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg. Kevin Systrom and Mike Krieger wrote in a statement on Instagram's website, "We're planning on taking some time off to explore our curiosity and creativity again." The announcement is yet another bump in Facebook's recent turbulence, which has faced criticism over the spread of fake news, alleged exploitation of user data with third parties, electoral interference, and its use as a platform for radical leaders to spread propaganda in developing countries. Systrom and Krieger founded Instagram in a San Francisco garage after meeting in 2010. 2 years later, with 13 employees and 30 million registered users, they sold it to Facebook for $715 million. It's now one of Facebook's most profitable sources of ad revenue. Instagram boasts in more than a billion users and was recently estimated by Bloomberg to be worth upwards of $100 billion. Well, that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.